story.
Oh, okay.
And if you or any of us rely on the recollection of former experience to establish confidence in the separate self, then that likewise is being conjured in present experience. You're making a proclamation from memory about your former and perhaps present condition. So you really got nothing but feeling tone. You got feeling tone. I'm not going to rob that from you. That'd be foolish.
Yeah. Okay, so that's all I've got is feeling tone. And everything else is just extrapolation off of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to bend your arm. Just suggesting that you consider it as a first-hand observation. What do you got? Feeling tone? Check. Anything else you got is an idea. Feeling tone persists of its own, call it, signature, its own vibratory nature, its own language. The feeling tone persists, seems to persist in its own language. And thought, likewise, arises spontaneously and is capable of telling a very compelling, if not hypnotic, story. And it also has its own, call it, you know, signature. Or wavelength, right? Within the bandwidth of experiencing, thought has a certain kind of wavelength. Feeling tone without thought has a certain kind of wavelength. If you agree with something, it has a wavelength. If you disagree with something, it has a wavelength. If you turn present experience into evidentiary basis for the existence of self, which you're quite capable and welcome to do, that has a certain wavelength. But in order for all of these wavelengths to be turned into a reliable or substantial world that either binds you or could free you, well, that is a complex hysteria. If we fail to see the mortar and bricks that construct a complex hysteria, then we remain under its sway. If you take the symptom tones of a complex hysteria, namely the conviction of self, and then run crazily into the day and crazily into the night seeking healing, then you're just a zombie who's managed to pull off his ankle bracelet and running hither and thither throughout life. You know, either imposing yourself on others or welcoming others to impose themselves on you. That's what we call life, which is just an abstract form of, you know, hysteria. Because it's based on, you know, dreams of self, and dreams of sorrow, dreams of greed, dreams of at-riskness. That's what we take into the so-called world as zombies that have bitten off our ankle, so we've bitten off our foot so we could remove our ankle bracelet and run about. I don't know. That's too harsh. And all of that arises out of the presumption that we could take feeling tone and tell each other what it is exactly. Construct a sense of self, self-determinism and at-riskness, and pride and silliness, greed, lust, and avarice, and of course, triumphant moments of awakened heart. We can pretty much demonstrate any weird thing within, you know, the human behavioral spectrum. So what?
So it seems to be that things happen to this thing called me.
But see, again, even that is you're relying on memory to suggest the presumption that something happened to you prior to this moment. And then you adhere to it as if that's evidence of this me to whom things have occurred prior to right about now, which is obviously a story, right?
Obviously, but
It's obviously a story. It's an outbreath of memory. And the only truth it has is the truth of whatever conviction that you give to it. If I agree with the shit that's coming out of your mouth, then now you've got two people agreeing with it. But I won't agree with it. So that just leaves you. And of course, you're welcome to it. You know, I'm not trying to pry anything from you or, you know, suggest that I can give anything to you. Both of those would be absurd. But I can hang out with you as a peer, you know, as a fellow pre-maggotory flesh bot, and take a look at what consciousness is trying to fool you about. As in right now and right here. Right now and right here is where the feeling tone is making itself known, right? You don't have feeling tone from the past. You might have remnant feeling tones of so-called events that occurred in that past. You don't have feeling tone of the future, even though you might have a curious premonition about things to come, right? You can only act or feel in what we refer to as present, the present. And if you look carefully at what we call the present and you notice an incredible spectrum of feeling tone, then that's what you have, an incredible spectrum of feeling tone. Only by your own assertion does this incredible spectrum of feeling tone suggest to you possession of an independent self. Memory you got, intelligence, the capacity for abstract association, abstract metaphor, speech, right? Language tools and language tones that can be used evocatively and hypnotically to communicate with each other, even though we're just using more or less random barking noises to evoke feeling tone in each other. We call that speech, listening to speech, and thinking that what we're saying could possibly be true. No, we're really just engaged in, you know, feeling tone visually to whatever extent the computer permits, and auditorially as the computer permits. We don't have what would you call, you know, present electromagnetic or electro bioelectric entanglement because we're not physically in the same room. You know, pheromonally, we can't communicate consciously or otherwise because we're not in the same room. So we have sound and sight, right? Two of five senses with which we can still create, you know, a marvelous, call it congealing of hypnotic, suggestive feeling tones. So we're feeling together through, wow, sight and sound. Far out. And we can read each other's facial expressions to some extent, or perhaps dialogue as that occurs. And in so doing, we get cues from each other about the shared nature of the feeling tone that we're having, though we can't possibly be certain what's going on with some other puppet in the room. We can just barely understand what's occurring in ourselves. It's a cold night, and, you know, to keep the saber-toothed tigers out, we keep a fire by the mouth of the cave, and we're just spooning. Yeah, this is what you do when it's cold out. Use spoon inside the cave. Keep the tigers away. I mean, for how many epochs have humans and their predecessors been sitting around a fire at night? Or a kiva? Right? Sharing the depth of their, you know, vitality, their humanity, their aromas and fluids with each other, keeping each other company, cozy company. It's a strange kind of nourishment, and we don't acknowledge it much in the industrialized West. So that's why everyone's up in a fucking 12-step meeting or a fellowship thereafter, because that's the replacement for the cave, for the fire pit that keeps everyone that would otherwise go astray, you know, tuned into the rhythm of the tribe. Otherwise, a chicken in every pot, you know, and a car in every garage has isolated our natural proclivity for community by isolating everyone in their own box with their own garden hose and their own washing machine and their own dishwasher. So the communal aspects of living together have turned into, you know, suburban neurosis or urban enmeshment. It's really fucking weird, you know, when you look at us from an organismic point of view, from a sacred architectural point of view, the structures that we've made and how we live, squared off, right, rooms, right angles, surrounded by right angles, which is not an appropriate feng shui for the dreaming capacity of a human being. We should have more, you know, cathedral-like ceilings or rounded dome-like structures that are more suitable to, you know, the feng shui of our own sense plenums, our own sense.
How would they be more suitable? Because they would be more evocative of the sense of togetherness.
Yes.
And
yes. Yeah. They're in all ways, you know, truly progressive bio architecture, Gaic architecture, right, would enhance our normal proclivities for sustenance and entertainment and rest than living in cubic structures. I mean, even bees have it together. At least they live inside of, you know, a hexagonal world. Right? Bees create hexagonal structures where eggs are laid and honey and royal jelly is stored. It's interesting, right, that a bee makes like a perfect fucking hexagon. What the hell is that? And we live in, you know, a cuboid world, which represses our own innate intelligence. But everything does.
But I think it just relocates the intent of it, just to emphasize something other than what you're talking
about. You see, it's not that difficult to redirect one's, let's just say, storyline and intentionality from the insistence on a separate self to just, you know, dream in a curious or melancholy manner about all kinds of, you know, curious observations that we could make about the weather, the temperature, the body, our living structures, right? Our social agreements, the movement of, you know, knowledge, accomplishment, celebrity. We can drift aimlessly, right, from, you know, topic of interest to topic of disinterest with the greatest of ease and not have to be beguiled or beleaguered by a separate sense of self, right? But you can always just create the self if you care to create a self by referencing memory or even attempting to reference present experience, and then assigning it, right, a conclusion, giving it a meaning. And the meaning of self is just as arbitrary as, you know, talking about the cover of Vogue magazine. We, you could say, define the self into being through a, let's just say, a narrow bandwidth of interpretation of the full spectrum of feeling tone. We reduce the profundity of feeling tone and imagination, intelligence, sensitivity, and capacity by converting it all into the kind of smug accusation of having a separate self. That's how we create the separate self. It's a smug accusation based on a really, really narrow-minded interpretation of the full spectrum of consciousness feeling itself. Knock yourself out. You're an etheric abundance.
But the understanding that you seem to be pointing to, positive understanding, it still seems like an understanding in the mind. It still seems to be, to me at the moment, it still seems to be located in I don't know, a reduced space.
Yes. Yes, that's right. Yeah, like a hyperthyroid and hypothyroid. What would you call this? A hypo location. Yeah, you're located. But if you really feel what's happening sensually, sensorially, somatically, you'll notice how soft all the edges are. It's not really located. Sensation of body is a remarkable kind of fuzzy, euphoric presentation. If you create boundaries, then, you know, you're welcome to do that. But there really is no boundary for, let's just call it, the apparent somatic concentration of you as a self, as a person.
Yeah.
There's no boundary. There's no boundary in the mind except one that you make up.
Is the creation of the idea of the mind itself a sort of basal concept, like a sense of boundedness? Like that there seems like this embodiment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even the, you know, the New Age fantasy of embodiment.
Yeah.
Right? Embodied healing, embodied enlightenment, embodied Zen, you know, embodied firewalking, right? Embodied. When you really take a, you know, casual look at all body, we're going to find another spectrum of sensation. The body is conjured. I mean, you can walk around and, you know, kind of feel yourself having a monkey cam perched on top of your shoulders. That's what's going on. There's a monkey cam perched on top of your shoulders. But that monkey cam sees through what you call your eyes and feeds data into what you might refer to or anyone might refer to as myself. But it's just an impersonal monkey cam sitting on top of what you might call your shoulders, gleaning incredible vistas of apparently three-dimensional objects in space, whether it's a room or on the highway, you know, on the BART, or, you know, down by the bay.
Your regular experience or your experience right now is of this rich texture of a feeling. There must be times where there's a narrowing of your focus, or is there just always like a
There's no always.
Yeah. Okay.
There can't be an always.
Is this a free-ranging attention or free-ranging awareness?
Well, whatever your experience has been up till now is what this is. If you're looking for a particular way to feel and see and hoping that particular or curious way of feeling and seeing will somehow persist, then you're just imagining that now, as if you could enter into a condition that could be reliably yours for the future. And everyone who's even a little bit of a seeker might understand why we would do that, why we would conjure a sense of, let's just call it self-realization appearing in someone else, or perhaps in ourselves, and wanting it to be whatever it might be, somehow persistent or consistent. I mean, what we're doing is truly a break from any way that you've ever felt about yourself prior to this moment, and any way you might hope to feel about yourself hence. Thus, it's possible to feel the curious texture of being presently awake. Right? What my condition might be now might have been prior to now, or what I might hope for it to be after now is just, right? What? It's dreaming. It's an idea. So you're filling your present experience with, right, ideation having to do with past, even present, and future, by imagining hypothetical conditions for yourself and perhaps contrasting them with me or with Frank or with Peter Brown or whomever. And that incredible capacity for contrast and assignment and, you know, rejection of someone or attraction towards someone or their condition is how samsara rolls. It just dreams right in your face. And we hope to find some kind of solace or some kind of finality in the midst of something that's dreaming right in your face. In a sense, you have to be willing not to know who you were a moment before now. You have to be willing not to know who or where or what you are right now, and certainly not be all that interested in what might become of you. That's how you foil, right, the habituation to samsaric impulse. By foiling one's habituation to samsaric impulse, you get a glimpse of what you might or might not be right about now, which has nothing to do how you might hope to feel in your enlightened future. You can't realize yesterday, and you can't realize tomorrow. But you got this. You got this feeling tone shit right in your face. No place else but here, but now. Even though even here and now are supercilious boundaries that you can't actually find. Because here is not a place, and now has no duration. So you just got feeling tone. Outside of the boundary field of some kind of implicit space or time or location or genesis or outcome or circumstance. Right? You got feeling tone.
And I've got no definition of that accompanies this feeling tone. I've got no contrast between this feeling tone and something else.
You can conjure it, or feeling tone can certainly conjure it. And, you know, you can take a big bite out of it and, you know, chew it to your heart's content. It can do it. That's how come samsara is samsara. Samsara is not some, you know, lightweight adversary. Samsara is right up your ass. Samsara is your inhalation and your exhalation. That's how intimate samsara is. It's not an adversary. It's yourself.
How is it that the feeling tone has no definition or qualities that can be said to accompany it, but it has what Peter Brown talks about in terms of a texture or different textures?
Well, that's what I was referring to. Not that I can, you know, dare be commenting on Peter Brown's teachings. But everything has its own signature, right? Wherever mind and consciousness may go, you know, it can wander into, let's say, parallel universes, parallel textures that all appear within what we're referring to as texture or feeling tone. Like we have to be somehow willing to let it just come to us, let it, if I may say, flood us. A lot of times, you know, the urgency to know, to figure it out, to place a blame, to anticipate a consequence, are, you could just say, curious deferral mechanisms of the warp and woof of samsara. More or less being unwilling to relax completely in feeling tone as an immersion, and then permit that immersion to reveal itself as emptiness. Presence without conjecture, presence without turning into a deliverable. As we listen metaphorically to the rhythms of feeling tone, released from the habit of conjecture, it has its own, you could say, song to sing. And your intelligence is lit not by knowledge. Your intelligence is lit by emptiness.
By what?
By emptiness, by just the cascading nature of availability. Cascading, euphoric availability without an object. No seeking needed. You see, if we blot out the demonstrative miracle of feeling tone as presence, then we get easily distracted by the myth of a past, the myth of a present, the myth of a future, the myth of a self, or some kind of remedy healing, amelioration of that self. Mwah, mwah, mwah. So it's more fun, I think, to use the power of thought, speech, listening, togetherness, words, to bring our attention, if you will, to, you know, euphoric simplicity.
Euphoric what?
Simplicity.
Adam Oxfield, he talks about this sort of stuff in terms of falling open.
Yes. Adam, uh-huh.
Yeah, Adam Oxfield, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. That's more or less the same thing. He talks about falling open of the mind, falling open of the body, and then falling open of something, a heart or whatever.
Well, Adam, I've had the privilege of, meeting Adam twice here in our neck of the woods.
Uh-huh.
And his game is a little, you know, Ramana Maharshi-like. He's, you know, demonstrably meditating. Or, you know, wearing certain airs in his body language and his behavior, right? He's demonstrating airs of yogic behavior in his body language and his speech. And making it look like, and maybe he very well is, you know, enjoying some kind of enlightenment. And he needs to show it to you. That he's enjoying something by being, wearing airs, behavioral airs, with his hands up and his, you know, right? So he's kind of meditating in your face. He's letting you know that he's dwelling in a condition that, you know, might interest you for $900. Right? And there's a certain kind of bullshit to that. And then he plays pop therapy with more or less naive seekers. Just Adam couldn't keep his shit together in a conversation like this because he doesn't know how to communicate in an egalitarian manner. So, like, you know, his predecessors and his present teachers, he is an abomination. It doesn't mean he's not a lovely guy. He's a lovely guy. He's a super fucking lovely guy. But when it comes to telling the truth about the truth, he is an abomination of, you know, demonstrable superciliousness. But that shit sells. People want to know they're in the hands, you know, of a holy person. So he plays the holy person thing.
But isn't there a sort of effectiveness to that sort of horse and pony show? It's like the horse and pony show of Paul Hederman and his selfing.
Somebody's gonna love somebody. Yeah, of course. You know, if you hang out with Adam Chaxfield and he gives you, you know, the right kind of cattle prod, you're gonna hang out with him again. If you get good cattle prod from Adam Chaxfield, you'll hang out with him. If you get good cattle prod from Paul Hederman, you'll hang out with him. Some kind of, camaraderie or hypnosis or whatever that makes you feel safe, noticed, loved.
The hypnosis is doing a certain something that's like inducing a certain state of awareness or whatever. It's like the whole talk about transmission, right? So like Peter Brown hung out with his guru for a while, and
They would drink sweet vermouth, and he would tell stories. Yeah.
There's a sort of aligning with a way of being that happens.
Yeah, there's the simplicity of feeling presence. Therefore, the conversation, you know, can be on point or humorous or silly or whatever, as long as there's a, what would you call it, you know, a shared serendipitous appreciation for what's really happening. Not that we can know what's really happening.
So could we say that there's a spooning going on between the guru and the student, and at some point, perhaps with this good spooning, the student becomes aware of the spooning or aware of the ongoing nature of spooning?
Yeah, that's right. Good spooning becomes good sodomy, and then you wake up. The Divine Mother turns the tables on you, and, you know, she puts on a strap on and does you. Yeah, all that you're suggesting is, you know, insightful, observant. Still, what happens is, you know, magical in its own right, but you can certainly refer to that atmosphere being present. And if that atmosphere is present for you, then it's, right, it's a place worth returning to. It's a relationship or a conversation worth returning to. If it nourishes something that you enjoy feeling. You don't have to do anything, but you don't have to not do anything. You don't have to go anywhere, but you don't have to not go anywhere. You don't have to believe in anything, but you don't have to not believe in anything.
Yeah. I have to plug in my computer before it goes out of me.
See, the moment you suggest sufficient solidity about yourself to have come from a place, to be the product of something, and have an interest in the condition of your future, well, you're too late. You've become too solid already. And having become that solid, then it might be accompanied by some qualities of unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, right? And then we want to resolve the dukkha by doing something as foolish as practicing the Eightfold Path, when it would have been much simpler just not to become sufficiently solid in the first place. So to live in imagination. Krishnamurti was deliberate in pointing out to Choyam Trungpa, and of course other listeners over a 50-year, you know, teaching arc, that the mind, what he referred to as the mind, had to become or was welcome to become still. So that another quality of nuance could be felt. I mean, so he was being a little materialistic, but he was in the, you know, was heading in a kind of a noble direction. Trungpa tried to interrupt him at one point, because it's not easy to interrupt Krishnamurti once he's on a roll, like it's not easy to interrupt Paul Hederman once he's on a roll, or Peter Brown. But Trungpa tried to interrupt when Krishnamurti was referring to this almost superhuman state of stillness. And Trungpa was trying to refute that that was a necessary precursor. But Krishnamurti didn't stop long enough to really indulge or entrain Trungpa's question. He just steamrolled him, which is cool. He was fucking Krishnamurti. Trungpa could kiss his ass. Or some people might say, that fucking Krishnamurti, he should have kissed Trungpa's ass. Right? Depends where your loyalty lies. When you're crazy, you're crazy. When you're still, you're still. When you're dreaming, you're dreaming. When you believe shit, you believe shit. When you get a break from believing shit, you get a break from believing shit. You know, some kind of sacred constancy. You know, that's for remarkable persons. Right? You know, you don't have to aim for the aim to emulate the good fortune of remarkable persons. You could just be you. That doesn't mean you're any more or less realized, as if there were such a thing, as anybody. Happiness is no measure. Abundance is no measure. Freedom from fear is no measure. Right? I mean, we envy all of these gurus. Why? Because they're happy, because they're freedom from fear, because they live with abundance, because they have a sense of humor, because they're perfectly elastic, because they sleep deeply. Or not at all, because they're always awake. You know, is that what you want too? You want to be like whomever your guru du jour is, guru of the week? Right? Oh, I want to be like Peter Fenner. Oh, I want to be like Richard Lang. Oh, I want to be like...
It's all I can be.
What? I want to have what she's having. You see many, if not most, of these teachers under contrived or false or theatrical circumstances, right? On a retreat, on a meeting, on a satsang, right? You don't see them on the bus when they've got, you know, diarrhea or constipation, right? Or when their wife or their lover, you know, pisses them off, or right? When they get accosted by, you know, a crazy seeker wanting to bite their head off, or when they're lavished with affection and, you know, love and financial and sexual favors from naive people that have that to give them in return. What, that's supposed to be like a sweet place to live? Right? We don't know the rhythm and the stress or the physical suffering or discomforts of these people that we may envy because of their so-called spiritual accomplishments. We see them under theatrical circumstances. It's better if you can, you know, if one is so inclined and you get a chance to hang with someone more intimately, right? You can kind of get a glimpse into the rhythm of their interests and movement and days and conversation and personality, right? So you can see the ebb and the flow of how they hang out, going to the movies and going to the bathroom and traveling through an airport, setting themselves up in a theatrical condition to have a 2-hour talk, you know, 4-hour talk, a 6-hour talk, a 4-day retreat. Right? There's no idealized destination. There's only always this rapturous moment to be felt with whatever depth you say you spontaneously bring to the table. I think we sometimes put that off by being clever about our future enlightenment and what we're going to do about it. Right? We avoid intimacy with the present as we try to accuse ourselves of or others of having enviable or disingenuous symptoms of something or other. That's how samsara works. It puts off the present by participating in imagination and temporality. That's how it manages to always be so successfully self-conniving, self-seducing. It's really a miracle. It's lovely. We're not even aiming for, you know, the end of suffering, which just turns out to be another kind of pile of shit. It's a little bold, I think. Maybe overbold to want to put an end to suffering. Either in oneself or in one's imagination of the world. Might be kind of too bold, or oddly, maybe paradoxically inconsequential. But this goes back to that loop that Krishnamurti was speaking about. Quite all right, love. Stillness of mind, or let's just say the enjoyment of attentivity without an object. Then there's no need to end suffering. One's own suffering or some other so-called person's suffering. How much does heaven and earth weep over the suffering of humanity? Who knows? Maybe heaven and earth is crying copious tears as we head, you know, straight into the wall of the next great extinction. Maybe not at all. Maybe heaven and earth just chilling, drinking a Labatt's, smoking a Turkish cigarette with a little latakia while we head into the sixth extinction. And yet we seem to care oh so much about the lamentation of our own lives, or feigning some kind of compassion or intervention in the lives of others. And yet very few people talk out loud with the sun during the day. You just don't see that many people walking through the parking lot on the way to the Piggly Wiggly saying, "Hey, sun, great to see you. Just love that you're in the sky. You're my favorite fusion orb anywhere. You're my favorite star of all stars in the entire cosmos. I love you, sun. I'm going to dip into this supermarket, but as soon as I come back out, I'm going to say hey, and we can keep our conversation going." Instead, we'd rather listen to conservative talk radio and pollute our minds with the misogynistic fascism of a real estate mogul named Donald Trump. We eat and drink and breathe poison every day, placed in our laps by, you know, oligarchical, misanthropic mad persons that may as well be lizards from another unfriendly planet.
They've got the, or they have had the most seductive hypnotism mechanism. Hypnotism engine going around.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
That's why we have cattle products in the way that they
that's
have.
Right. That's right. You're getting cattle prodded by, you know, the oligarchical class hell-bent on depopulation. You're getting cattle prodded by the gurus that portray theatrical, you know, superficialities so that you can be enlightened like them. You're getting cattle prodded by the media and the banks, right? Yeah. By the Divine Mother, everything is taking you out to dry, hanging you out to dry. It's not easy to, what would you say, find a cave where you can spoon and get a few minutes of, you know, restful dignity. It's like the great dehydration of consciousness.
What do you mean, the great dehydration of consciousness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's going from, you know, plump, juicy grape to dried raisin.
In terms of the planet and the upcoming mass extinction?
Who knows? Imagine being a young person, you know, wanting to feel some confidence or chart a course for a sustainable future.
Uh-huh.
must be quite a challenge for them.
Yeah.
Looking somewhere in the public sphere for a role model.
And meanwhile they're locked in the spooning embrace with their technological objects.
Yes. That's right. Right. I mean, part of their heartbreak and unconscious frustration is somewhat addictively ameliorated by superficial social media. An endless stream of banal entertainment. It's like the, you know, the decline of the last generations. Before artificial intelligence gets blended with genetic engineering. And the oligarchy class actually controls the manufacture and acumen of lower classes that are genetically or bioengineered or replaced by, you know, a programmable hominid. But you know, science fiction is, this kind of science fiction is really no different than the science fiction of my own mind, the science fiction of my own life, the science fiction of my own sense of self. We think that, what, life on Main Street is real? Life at the caucus is real? The Republican and Democratic debaters of the issues of the day is somehow real. It's not a science fiction. I mean, it's a little unsteadying to begin to see that the world you imagine you're living in is a science fiction, right? The discovery that the world we're living in and the stewards of the earth and the stewards of ethical conduct and the stewards of the environment and the stewards that are supposed to protect the constituency from the ravenous and eco-terrorism of corporate overlords is not present, has failed in their jobs. So we're living in a time of, you know, surreal opportunism where everyone and everything is treated as collateral damage. That's some pretty scary shit if you're, you know, if you think you're living a life or you want your kids to have one or your kids' kids to have one. But that's also the nature of the science fiction of denial. You know, the guru doesn't dare talk about, what would you call it? Topics close to home, right? Topics close to sustainability. They'd rather you be wrapped up in lofty concerns like the self, because most of them don't know how to cope with the challenge of juxtaposing spiritual revelation with, let's just call it, the practicality of how few years everyone has left to live. They'd rather talk about their eating disorders and their dark nights of the soul and all of this absolutely useless horseshit to entrain more students into some kind of empathy than tackle the profound conundrum affecting and facing the species at large. Not just from an escapist point of view that might sound like Dzogchen Chen or Kashmiri Shaivism. Right? Or the empty calories of something that might be referred to as transmission. While we're all being cattle prodded to death by just about everything. But to get fixated, you know, on geopolitical existentialism or non-dual existentialism or enlightenment existentialism, to get fixated on anything at all in the midst of a, you know, a profound and provocative, if not imaginary, conversation, serves to help us, you know, forget the simplicity of your euphoric being. The simplicity of euphoric being shouldn't have to defend itself against anything, nor should it feel so smug to be able to exclude anything. You can create a great YouTube persona as concerns being an ambassador of not self. You can even travel the world being an ambassador of enlightenment, self-realization, not self. You can go to retreats and very comfortable places, all expenses paid, and come out even with, you know, a couple $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in your pocket. Byron Katie does a 9-day, you know, intensive in the work. It costs a lot of money, and there are many, many people that show up, and who knows, the after cost profit of that event could be very, very substantial, like hundreds of thousands of dollars. That was what we might call monetizing celebrity. In the name of what? Self-realization? Bullshit. People just become indoctrinated in another body of hallucination to keep themselves in the game. Now they have a solution for what they imagine ails them. And they're happy to teach you that solution, become certified in the use of that solution. And if they're lucky, they'll make a fraction of the money that Byron Katie does, being at the very top of the pyramid. That doesn't mean it's real or unreal or valuable or not valuable. It's hard to say.
Another question. This is a very different topic, I think.
Yay.
So I was rereading some Nietzsche or this commentary on Nietzsche, and so Nietzsche talks about affirmation and negation, right? And he talks about these three figures of the camel, the lion, and the child, mm-hmm. right? And there's this camel is just the one that accepts the burden, right? So it's kind of like the first level of affirmation, which is this acceptance of what is one shitty past and one shitty present and mm-hmm. One shitty self. Right. And then there's what follows that initial sort of superficial affirmation is the no of the lion, right, which is itself an affirmation, right? That it's a denial of all the sort of reactive qualities that are abiding in that initial affirmation, right? So and Nietzsche he critiques the real simplistic Christianity for just making that first affirmation, right? And
yes.
So Christ goes on the cross and, you know, bears all of our burdens and, oh, isn't this nice? And, you know, it's the sort of shitty Christianity of, oh, your husband is beating you. That's your cross to bear and just accept it, and, right?
Ouch.
So the no of the lion, which me reading those two, I think of the sort of kind of simplistic but nice and sweet just open heartedness that you hear about, right? Just be open hearted, love and whatever. And that gets you, that's nice in its way, it's useful in its way, but then you get shit on by lots of people who take advantage of the nice guy, whatever. And then there's after, eventually once you get shit on enough, then there's a no of, there's like a deeper affirmation that takes place. One could say that there's the affirmation of not just, oh, I love you, fellow humanity, but I love this that I am, you know, that is conceived as something not to be shit on, or I love that. That which is not necessarily reactive, what is something deeper, right? And so it kind of sounds like integrity to a certain extent. And then Nietzsche talks about there's a third affirmation that comes after that, which is the child, and that's just like the being of becoming is just this pure creative affirmation, right? So, anyways, I wonder what you would say to that sort of camel, lion, child progression or way of framing things.
Yeah, it doesn't drag a lot out of me to be honest.
That's all right.
I mean, I kind of get the scent of the archetypes that he's referring to. you know, within a kind of a Judeo-Christian context. And then, you know, animating those archetypes, right? Twice with animals and once with an infant human child.
It's like, well, let's say we just sounds great. So what you were talking about earlier, like you were talking about the spooning stuff, right? The spooning happens with the guru or supposed guru, you know, and people are wanting that, and that's nice. And then you get this layer maybe of, oh, I understand that this guy's a fraud or is blowing smoke up my ass or just hypnotized. What's his name? Adam Toxfield is an abomination.
But who knows? Who knows how many people will enter into a spiritual mentoring relationship with Adam Toxfield and be nourished or disappointed or perhaps, you know, wake up and join Jeannie Zandi's, you know, inner circle. You know, and become ambassadors of self-realization so that they can make a living too. By doing whatever they can get away with, you know, feigning spiritual accomplishment and theatrical presentation. I have no idea. I mean, the only way to really find out, you know, is to, like, give yourself over to it. Right? Like, if Adam Toxfield has the privilege of being in your life and you in his, then you give yourself over to whatever relationship, monetized or not, that Adam Toxfield may be willing to enter into with you. It may only be a monetized relationship through the more or less controlled circumstances of his, you know, phone calls and retreats. Right? He might not take a walk with you at the bulb and smoke a fatty. You know, and then go out for noodles. Or, you know, to Nations in El Cerrito and get a greasy burger. I don't know. See, that's why it's difficult to really say much, because you have to go through the fire. If someone like Adam Toxfield has a fire and is willing for you to participate in that fire, in a way that's not just controlled and monetized. You know, on a Saturday morning, after Paul Hederman speaks eloquently, there's, you know, a small handful of people that go out for coffee and hang with him and each other casually, sometimes satisfactorily, sometimes with a load of distraction. And then after that, maybe even fewer people go out for Chinese food or, you know, vegan epicure. And then, you know, stay in the fire a little longer than the 1 hour long presentation, where they might meet him, you know, somewhere at a farmer's market for coffee and casual conversation, you know, after a 12-step meeting. Peter Brown, similarly. You know, you figure out how to weasel your way in to get whatever intimate exposure you can possibly get, if that's your karma, if that's what, you know, turns you on. Otherwise, you know, we wait around for Isaac Shapiro to come back year after year and just say the same old garbage as if you're on some kind of fucking mindfulness retreat. Fuck you, Isaac. Or you end up in the hell realm of Bentinho Massaro, converting, you know, the sacred simplicity of self-realization to some kind of spiritual empowerment three-ring circus under a big tent where your will and your power and your imagination and your this and your that grants you, you know, both a happy, empowered, manifested life and realization all together, the total package. And every greedy motherfucker who's tired of being themselves jumps right in. Or Adyashanti comes to town and you win the lottery and you go for a week-long retreat. And it's great because it's quiet and there's meditation and little exercise and good food. And you get to, you know, meditate with Adya or ask him questions, you know, during two teaching sessions a day during the week. Microphones are set up so people can ask spiritual questions. And he gives his, you know, provocative milk toast answers in a very non-intimate way. And everyone feels like they got the best of Adyashanti. Nobody sat in the stall in the men's room next to him, you know, and listened to the sounds emanating from his ass after he was cleansing himself from, you know, his breakfast. He regales himself as a, you know, as a god. And he might very well be one. I don't know.
So the transmission effect is more powerful in intimate context.
Well, the transmission effect actually turns out to be you. You're the recipient and the broadcaster and the content and the plenum of what we might call transmission. It's always been you.
In a very general, abstract way?
No, in a very intimate way. You are the transmission.
Could you say more about that? Because your words would serve as a wall separating me from the truth.
It's curiously simple. If you're reliant upon anything, first outside yourself, secondarily within yourself, to be the evidentiary basis for your own self-realization, you're lost. You're lost in fantasy by relying on anything outside yourself and relying on anything inside yourself to be the evidence of your hoped-for self-realization, you are lost. But that's cool. That's not a bad thing. I mean, without that, how would Byron Katie be a multimillionaire? So in her case, it's a good thing. But the real transmission is the discovery that you turn out to be the transmission, right? You are the emanator, the broadcaster, the recipient, the content, the context. You are the emptiness in which this transmission appears to occur. It's not between persons. It's not from to.
But I think I would be more comfortable with some sense of triangulation.
That's why ego is spelled E-G-O. Three letters. Because there's a triangulation going on. The cessation of this triangulation appearing in you or as you, that's realization, that's transmission. The cessation of your own, call it, habit of triangulation.
And that just stops of its own sometime, maybe?
Well, what you think has begun never actually begun or began. So there's no actual reason for it or anything to stop.
On that note, I bid you good night.
Thank you, sir. Enjoy a good rest.
I got you all to myself again.
Sorry.
I scared off all those other guys.
It was his bedtime.
Well.
Might it be possible for presence to be what it already is, impersonally appearing? Not asking for permission, not insisting upon a before, a present, or an after, not requiring an explanation.
But that that game is so entertaining of being a acting like a good boy and getting permission. And
I hear you. Sure. Which suggests that you're extroverting or introverting, seeking some kind of triangulation with something other than this, or other than yourself. This urgency, you could say, for establishing, right, a relationship with some kind of animus is provocative and prevailing, and there's nothing right or wrong with it. It's the, right, the profusion of the exhibitionism or extortion of insisting on some kind of relationship with animus, like God is animus, like Wilson, the soccer ball is animus, like my own sorrow is a form of animus, right? Yeah. We are driven, I mean, profoundly, you dare I say biologically or sub-biologically, extraterrestrially, if you want to use that. We're driven to, right, interface with conscious contact through animus, through other, through conversational memes. And so we create instantaneously, at a minimum, you know, a bipolar schizophrenia within ourselves so that we have someone to talk to. Right? We create animus within ourselves. That could be a shaming or blaming voice, a greedy or aspirational voice, right? A spiritual voice, a political voice. But it seems like we've always got the radio on, the radio of ourselves, the dreaming, hypnotic radio of ourselves. which, and it's compulsive, and it's, well, I mean, it's impersonal. It's maybe it's not compulsive. It's just compulsory, right? Consciousness. It's a compulsory animation of consciousness itself, that it participates in animus. Someone or something to have a conversation with. And that's how the building blocks of self are constructed. Legos. Through this incredibly creative, wonderful, multivalent, spectral fascination of animus as texture, pattern recognition, thought, story, feeling, sensation, playing chess with the future, playing repackage the past. That's what we're up against, is this absolutely miraculous urgency for stereophonic experience, self and other. Even within ourselves, it's self and other. Good luck breaking the back of that shit.
And when that starts to wind down, then does it become like this, the dialogue seems to carry on between this supposed me and some supposed God?
Find out. I don't know if it's possible to articulate some kind of universally acceptable destination. I mean, we can't put all the enlightened people in the same room and put pins in their feet and see who screams last. Whoever screams last is the most enlightened, or they just might have, you know, the most tough feet.
So, in your experience, was there like for a period of time there was some sort of personage, some abstract personage you would call a God or the divine or something?
I went to see the Jesus movie today called Risen, right? Kind of an Easter timely escapade. And I was the last one to leave the theater because, of course, I was busy checking my cell phone after the movie was over before the credits finished. And before I left the theater, I bowed in delicious reverence to a blank screen. It felt good to be a soldier of Christ in that moment.
Yeah.
Why would you hesitate to enjoy that?
Yeah.
It was as I was leaving the theater after a really luscious, long bow. It's just like, placing my head at the Master's feet. Oh, it's just wonderful. So as I was musing to myself leaving the theater, I thought of myself as a kind of a Christian ganja baba. Strange combination of, you know, devotional interests. Or whatever. I mean, bow deeply at everything and everyone simply for the, you know, delicious salve of your own soul. It's wonderful, you know. Bow deeply to this. Bow deeply to yourself. Bow deeply to God in heaven, God on earth. Bow deeply to the sorrow and lamentation of humankind.
Was it a good movie?
I liked it. I thought it was fun to see Jesus' closest disciples socializing with him after he had risen from the grave and had reanimated his body in a robust, plump, re-plump, rehydrated manner. Yeah, so there he was, chilling with his buds, scratching their heads and hugging them and loving them up. And then disappearing in a flash. And then appearing again at the Sea of Galilee, partying with them again. They were just beside themselves to see him not just once, but a second time, hanging out for a couple of days. The miracles of fish and the miracle of healing a leper by restoring his skin to, you know, perfect health, feeding him a fried fish, a grilled fish, hugging him and kissing him and wrapping him in robes. Like, who wouldn't hang out with that motherfucker?
Yes.
And all the devotees, when, you know, whenever Jesus was not around, you know, they would all be yelling, Yeshua, Yeshua. I mean, they were consumed with him. Why shouldn't they be? They were in the company of, you know, a yogi of incredible magnitude, the living God, the Son of the living God. Whatever that means to you, you know, or not. They were just beside themselves, hanging out in the glorious, affectionate company of the Son of the living God. Rock on.
And you don't feel any of that same sort of pull to, like, I don't know, Amma or Mother Mira or these other supposed
incarnations
of the divine?
I've seen Amma. I never had the privilege of hanging out with Mother Mira, but I did read some of the overindulgent, elaborate frothing of one of her devotees. What's his name? The author.
Yeah.
I forget his name. He's kind of he's like a fraction of a Rumi.
Yeah. Coleman Barks?
No. Paul Harvey? Andrew Harvey?
Oh, that guy, he was, was it Father Bede or something like that? Was his first main guru or something?
Don't remember his provenance.
Oh, okay, sure, yeah. Well, okay, yeah.
I think he had a Sufi-ish background. Whatever that implies.
He's an English guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he was, he's a big fan of Baba B as well. Like he, I don't know, he went and interviewed him and got to know him real well and wrote a book with him or something.
What fun.
Yeah. Right before he died. Right before Father B died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, that would make sense. Yeah. So, what did he say in his elaborate frothing that...
I don't recall. He was just singing Mother Mira's praises as one might effuse, right, over... Hindu or Christian or Sufi goddess.
Yeah. So is that different from the relation you have to the empty screen when you're bowing? He doesn't realize that the screen is empty.
Well, you could say it's kind of nice to bow to, right? The ineffable. You know, we are the anthropomorphization of the ineffable, right? The universe is the anthropomorphization of the inevitable, the Gaic field, which includes Mother Mira and Amici and whoever figured out the Sedona method. That was the challenging part of the Risen movie. Right. Well, it was that, you know, certainly understandable and enviable fawning and intoxication that Jesus, Yeshua's devotees had for him, around him. But, you know, they were also portrayed as having their various foibles and Achilles' heels in terms of how their faith was tested, how they lived, how they died, as they began the incredible task of teaching, right, the Christian Dharma. Unfortunately, in the media, we don't see much evidence of, what would you call it, pious and fearless persons. You know, the Pope is, of course, right, as top of the heap when it comes to a pious and fearless person. But even the world has become far too complex and juxtaposed for the Pope to get a handle on, or for the Dalai Lama to get a handle on, or for Wayne Dyer, God rest his soul, to get a handle on. Right? I mean, world leaders, including the Pope, have decried the hateful speech and inhumanity of the mouth and behavior of Donald Trump, let's say. And there aren't enough Christians to withdraw their support from such a comical farce of a human being that he might become president of these United States. So even the Pope, in his bold, you know, political and spiritual commentary on the behavior of the front-running Republican candidate, wasn't enough, nearly enough, to derail his popularity. So it's a strange world that we live in, that a character of dark foolishness like Donald Trump would have more stay power and influence than the Holy Father of the Catholic Church. So that shows you that even the Pope, a pious, ethical, and truly generous soul, is marginalized by hubris and stupidity. And then, of course, we see the antics of the ultra-Republicans and the Tea Party and the so-called Christian right. How did these persons that would call themselves Christians end up with the politics and the indulgent foolishness of their spiritual and cultural memes? Repressive, suppressive, belittling, aggressive, fascistic. How is it possible that the oligarchs were able to have their will done through the dupes of the Christian right? And the Pope can just piss off. So yeah, it was kind of nice to see Christ in his abundant glory. I mean, he could manifest food, he could raise spirits, he could heal the sick. I mean, he was, right? I mean, a radiant cornucopia of absolute abundance. You'd be an idiot not to be joyous, desirous of his company. He was the Son of the living God. It seems like things have gone a little bit south since he departed by ascending into a ball of light.
Yeah.
Oops. The church became an enclave for hundreds of years or more to harbor an activized cult of pedophilia and repression, global, globally mandated, globally permitted pedophilia and sexual predation and the repression of same. That's Jesus's church, entwined with money and politics. I mean, excuse me.
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, I've had the pleasure of your company for 2 hours here.
Sorry. Sorry to deplete you.
Depleted at all. I feel very honored to be able to basically be all to myself for 2 hours.
It's what I do on a Tuesday night.
Well, I'm glad to have done that with you.
Pleasure is mine. We'll see you again.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
You bet.
Bye-bye.